implement these prohibitions, noting that some U.S. intelligence programs collect broad streams of internet or telephone data in a way that can scoop up information on Americans, such as when someone is communicating with a target of surveillance who lives overseas. This is known as incidental collection, and it's an issue lawmakers in both parties have flagged as a violation of civil liberties and personal privacy. Number two, the nature of the surveillance is unclear. Several publications have pointed out that the nature of the surveillance isn't really clear, yet the language in the redacted letter suggests the program involves non-traditional surveillance, noting data collection is done in bulk and uses backdoor searches of Americans, the same issue that has generated bipartisan concern in the FISA context. As the ACLU says, this implies the spy agency may be vacuuming up vast amounts of information to spy on Americans and storing it indefinitely. Number three, the surveillance is warrantless. While the nature of the surveillance is murky, Senators Wyden and Heinrich make one thing clear. The information being collected is warrantless, meaning the data are being scooped up without a warrant. This directly violates the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which states the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures, shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. And number four, the program appears to be unlawful. While what constitutes spying is debatable, but Wyden and Heinrich suggest that the program may have exceeded its lawful bounds. While the senators don't use the words unlawful or illegal, they suggest the program may be just that, noting it falls entirely outside the statutory framework that Congress and the public believe govern this collection. What the precise statutory framework isn't spelled out here, but it's safe to say that Wyden believes that the CIA is acting outside that of a scope. Number five, the CIA is acting without oversight. While there has been a great deal of discussion on the idea that the FBI's FISA warrant process is broken, it's worth noting that at least that program had some judicial oversight, weak as it often was. Wyden and Heinrich suggest this is not the case with CIA's data collection program, which they say operates without any of the judicial, congressional, or even executive branch oversight that comes from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. At number six, this isn't Wyden's first dust-up with CIA. Finally, it's worth noting that this is not the first time Wyden has clashed with the CIA over rogue operations. In 2016, the senator from Oregon had a heated exchange with then CIA Director John Brennan over the CIA's improper search of Senate files, including the unauthorized search of the emails of Senate staffers investigating the CIA's use of torture in the so-called War on Terror. Brennan denied the CIA's actions were improper, even though both a CIA Inspector General and a review board appointed by Brennan himself conceded the search resulted in an appropriate access to the Senate's work product, prompting a sharp rebuke from Biden. In 2013, Biden also asked Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, if the NSA collected any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans. Clapper responded, "No, sir, not wittingly." It was later revealed the NSA was in fact collecting metadata on millions of law-abiding Americans without warrants. Many thinkers have written about the dangers of bureaucracy, a system in which important decisions are made not only by individuals or even elected representatives, but state officials. The famed writer and traveler Alexei D. Togavey saw bureaucracy as the Achilles heel of modern democracy. A century later, the great economist Ludwig von Mises wrote an entire book about its nature and evils, bureaucracy. The tentacles of the U.S. bureaucratic state do not reach as far as those of states in the 20th century, the period in which Arendt wrote, but as early as the 1930s, government reports have warned about a headless fourth branch of the government responsible to no one. That was more than 80 years ago. Now, there is a secret CIA program that has been spying on Americans free from any kind of oversight for an undetermined length of time. This sounds just a bit like the terror Arendt described. What happens next, however, is unclear. The list of U.S. intelligence scandals and improper programs has grown lengthy in recent years, but accountability has been elusive. We will see if this time is any different.
In late August 2021, almost 2 weeks after the fall of the government in Kabul, U.S. President Joe Biden delivered a speech in defense of withdrawing American troops from Afghanistan.
To those asking for a third decade of war in Afghanistan, I ask, what is the vital national interest? In my view, we only have one: to make sure Afghanistan can never be used again to launch an attack on our homeland.
The withdrawal was chaotic, but the president had taken his bold decision and stance. Now, more than 1 year into Biden's presidency, this boldness looks like a temporary aberration in U.S. foreign policy. The White House has followed a foreign policy that is unclear on core issues. This chaotic approach has shown itself most vividly in the Biden administration's effort to revive the Iran nuclear deal, known also as the JCPOA.
It's not time to give up. There is some progress being made. The P5+1 is on the same page, but it remains to be seen.
In his presidential campaign in 2020, Biden left little doubt concerning the deal. In an op-ed for CNN, he wrote, "If Iran returns to strict compliance with the nuclear deal, the United States would rejoin the agreement as a starting point for follow-on negotiations." But in practice, Biden has shown indecisiveness so far. For months, the U.S. president and his team debated whether to enter the JCPOA or to seek a new agreement. After the administration decided to re-enter, it began an after-you game with Iran, laying out a set of conditions and asking Tehran to make the first move, which Tehran rejected outright.
I have to tell you, recent moves, recent rhetoric, don't give us a lot of cause for optimism. Even though the hour is getting very late, it is not too late for Iran to reverse course and engage meaningfully in an effort to return to mutual compliance with the JCPOA.
The Iranians say since the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal, it ought to take the first move, meaning to lift sanctions and to unfreeze Iran's financial assets. Moreover, given Biden's predecessor's unpredictability, the Iranians want the White House to guarantee that it won't repeat what Trump did in 2018 when he pulled out of the deal. That said, when it comes to nuclear agreements, the Americans never follow through on their word. For example, in 1994, the U.S. signed the framework agreement with North Korea to end its nuclear program, but the U.S. never lived up to its obligations under the deal, which included the construction of a light water nuclear reactor and normalizing diplomatic relations, and Pyongyang walked away. Or in the case of Libya, Muammar Gaddafi voluntarily gave up his nuclear program, but that didn't stop the U.S. from actively supporting forces who toppled his government and brutally killed him.
Of course, the big news this week, Gaddafi's dead, rebel forces, killed by rebel forces. Your reaction, your take on this?
Well, this is somebody who for 40 years had terrorized his country, had supported terrorism, and he had an opportunity during the Arab Spring to finally let loose of his grip on power and to peacefully transition to democracy. We gave him ample opportunity and he wouldn't do it.
Trump's withdrawal from the Iran deal is just the latest case. Against such a backdrop, demanding even more concessions from Tehran does not seem to be the wisest move to revive the deal.
We are very clear-eyed about the hurdles that remain. These talks will be structured around working groups that the EU is going to form with the remaining partners in the JCPOA, including Iran. And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA.
Since most of the sanctions on Iran are based on executive action, there is nothing stopping Biden from going back into the deal. But it seems that Biden is unwilling to upset Iran hawks on Capitol Hill, in particular Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey, who is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Since Menendez is a vocal critic of the Iran nuclear deal, Biden is reportedly afraid of provoking him because he would block or slow roll the administration's foreign policy nominees. As Matt Duss, foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders, put it, they don't hate the deal because it's a bad deal. They hate the deal because it's a deal with Iran. Full stop. On the JCPOA, there is no consensus to be built with the anti-Iran hawks. The enmity towards Iran is partly due to pressure from powerful interest groups, including the pro-Israel lobby. As Bill Clinton's Middle East envoy Kenneth Pollack once said, from a political standpoint, nobody pays a price to be tough on Iran.
And this is the same spirit that, you know, I want to bring to our relationship of cooperation, of goodwill, of friendship. We're going to be talking about a bunch of issues, primarily how do we fend off and curtail Iran's pursuit to dominate the region.
Israel's security is and always will be unshakable. And we look forward to addressing all of these challenges that we face, particularly regional security and the deep concerns that we share about Iran and the role that it's playing in the region, including its nuclear program.
It's very unlikely that Biden will be able or at least willing to defy this lobby. When Barack Obama came into office, he tried to ease mistrust between Tehran and Washington through a series of peacemaking gestures, such as addressing the Iranians on their new year or writing letters to the leaders of Iran.
So in this season of new beginnings, I would like to speak clearly to Iran's leaders. We have serious differences that have grown over time. My administration is now committed to diplomacy that addresses the full range of issues before us and to pursuing constructive ties among the United States, Iran, and the international community.
But he finally gave in to pressure from then-Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and as a result adopted anti-Iran policies by imposing sanctions on the country. It was just late in his presidency when he decided to reach an agreement with Iran. Biden, who was Obama's vice president, is now confronted with a similar anti-Iran scenario. Recently, about 200 House Republicans wrote to Biden warning any nuclear deal made with Iran without Congress approval will meet the same fate as the 2015 agreement by Obama, which was later abandoned by Trump. On the other hand, Biden's plunging approval rating has made the administration more timid in its approach to international affairs. Biden is afraid of the backlash from appearing to make concessions to the Islamic Republic. In the words of Jeffrey Lewis of the Middlebury Institute of International Studies, Biden is a wimp. He would have taken a political hit for taking a chance on the Iranians that might or might not have worked out, but it would have put the ball in Iran's court. Trump is gone, but his Iran policy is still in place. If the Biden administration wants to be more than a historical footnote on U.S. foreign policy, it needs to be more decisive. It needs to take action on decisions it has adopted rhetorically. The clock is ticking.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new report reveals U.S. military academies remain inundated by institutional racism despite minor gains since proclaiming anti-discrimination policies a decade ago to bring in more racially diverse students. Here we present you an article in this regard written jointly by our own Morrison, Helen Wiffering, and Noreen Nasir, titled, Report Says U.S. Military Academies Remain Plagued by Racism. Stay tuned for more. According to an AP report, 8 years after he graduated from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, African-American Jeffrey Easterlink remains astonished by the Confederate history still memorialized on the storied Academy's campus. The 6-foot-tall painting of Confederate Gen Robert E. Lee in the library, the barracks dormitory named for Lee, and the Lee Gate on Lee Road. He remembers feeling devastated as a black student at the Army Academy when a classmate pointed out that the slave also depicted in the Lee painting. He recalls thinking, as quoted in the report, how did the only black person who got on a wall in this entire humans school, how is it a slave? Easterlink later traveled the country as a diversity admissions officer to recruit the students from underrepresented communities to West Point and observed, "It was so hard to tell people, like, yeah, you can trust the military." And then their kids Google and go, "Why is there a barracks named after Lee?" According to the report, American military academies provide a key pipeline into the leadership of the armed services, and for the better part of the last decade, they have welcomed more racially diverse students each year. However, beyond blanket anti-discrimination policies, these federally funded institutions offer little details about how they screen for extremist or hateful behavior or address the racial slights that some graduates of color say they face daily. Earlier this year, AP published another report in which current and former enlistees and officers in nearly every branch of the armed services described a deep-rooted culture of racism and discrimination that stubbornly festers despite repeated efforts to eradicate it. Less attention has been paid to the premier institutions that produce a significant portion of the services officer corps. The academies of the U.S. Army and the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Coast Guard, and U.S. Merchant Marine. According to the report, some graduates of color from top U.S. military schools who endured what they describe as a hostile environment are left questioning the military maxim that all service members wearing the same uniform are equal. That includes Carlton Shelley II, who was recruited to play football for West Point from his Sarasota, Florida high school and entered the academy in 2009. On the field, he described the term as a brotherhood where his skin color didn't matter. But off the field, he said he and other black classmates too often were treated like stereotype of the angry black man. Some students of color have spotlighted what they see as a systematic discrimination at the academies by creating Instagram accounts, Black at West Point, Black at USAFA, and Black at USNA, to relate their personal experiences. The latest annual defense spending bill mandated that the Defense Department survey all its military properties for references or symbols that potentially commemorate the Confederacy, including at West Point, which the commission overseeing the work picked as its first site to visit earlier this year. But the deadline to act on any recommendations is still more than 2 years away. Following the murder of George Floyd in 2020, which sparked global protest, a group of West Point alums released a 40-page letter urging the academy to address major failures in combating intolerance and racism, adding, "We hold fast to the hope that our alma mater will take the necessary steps to champion the values it espouses." Shelley said the academy has significant work to do to retain and support students of color. He said in his class, he estimated about 35 black students graduated, some crazy low number, adding, "And we started with a lot of more." Citing 2019 data from the Under Secretary of Defense, the report notes the academies are a growing pathway to officer status for black cadets, with about 13% of black active duty officers commissioned through the five institutions compared to 19% of white active duty officers. Most students who enroll, nearly 60 to 70%, are nominated by U.S. senators or representatives from their home states as part of a system created in 1840s to build a geographically diverse officer corps. However, today the country's changed demographics mean the system gives disproportionate influence to rural congressional districts that tend to be whiter. According to a March report by the Connecticut Veterans Legal Center, only 6% of nominations to the Army, Air Force, and Naval Academies made by the current members of Congress went to black candidates, even though 15% of the population aged 18 to 24 is black. The report said 8% of congressional nominations went to Hispanic students, though they make up 22% of young adults. The diversity of nominations has improved slightly in the past 25 years, but the report noted that 49 Congress members did not nominate a single black student while in office and 31 nominated no Hispanic candidates. While the number of Hispanic cadets increased in the past two decades at the Coast Guard and Naval Academies, black cadets showed no noticeable increase during that time. In the class of 2000, there were 73 black midshipmen in Naval Academy and just 77 in 2020. At the Coast Guard Academy, there were 15 black cadets in the 2001 class, and in 2021, merely 16. Two of the five academies, West Point and the Air Force Academy, now have their first black leaders. But Sterling, the West Point graduate, noted that the faculty there remains mostly white, meaning students who don't see themselves and don't want to stay can find it hard to ask for help. Greg Elliott said he often found himself in trouble as a midshipman at the Merchant Marine Academy and was asked to leave without graduating. He doesn't blame the academy for his mistakes, and he said he never faced overt racism, but he wonders if a more diverse faculty and student body could have changed his course by making him feel he belonged. He remembers a fellow black alum telling him to just plow through with his head down and realize the academy was a terrible place to be at, but it's a great place to be from. Both Sterling and Shelley said they also saw signs of extremism during their time in the army. Timothy Berry, a former Army field artillery officer who graduated from West Point in 2013 and served as class president, said he never felt comfortable reporting racist incidents while at the academy, fearing it would draw unwanted scrutiny to him not being a perfect cadet, however minor his shortcomings might be. An Inspector General's report last year found the Coast Guard Academy had mishandled nearly a dozen race-based harassment charges between 2013 and 2018, and also noted that harassment was underreported in part because of concerns about negative consequences. Lieutenant Commander Kimberly Young McLear, a black woman who taught at the academy from 2014 to 2019, said she herself faced years of harassment and retaliation on campus, which she had detailed in congressional testimony. Although the academies play a big role in the diversity of military leadership, some have argued that the pipeline begins even earlier. At the high school level, the Department of Defense sponsors junior ROTC programs at high schools around the country where students can learn the values of the armed services run drills, and wear the uniforms. According to a 2017 study sponsored by the Secretary of Defense, the programs are often located at high schools with larger than average populations of students of color. Though it may not be an official recruitment program, Junior ROTC promotes the military branches as a pathway to excellence. Cadets' handbooks for Navy, Army, Air Force, and Marine Corps all stipulate non-discrimination policies with regard to race and gender and emphasize treating everyone with dignity and respect. But former Junior ROTC instructor Cardell Anthony Hopkins said little was done after one of his students at Lake Brantley High School in Florida alerted him to social media posts by her fellow cadets making racist comments about Hopkins, a retired black master sergeant.
Being the second largest country in the Middle East, Iran is rich with a colorful bouquet of architectural masterpieces, magnificent mosques, ancient caravanserais, impressive rock tombs, and former royal cities of the ancient Persian Empire. But perhaps Iran's amazing desert landscape has been largely overlooked. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Iran's deserts are unique in the variety of their composition and surface types. A yardang, or kalut, as they're called in Farsi, is a topographical feature that has been carved out of a surface by the wind. They're most commonly found in deserts where there is a sand supply, which abrades the surface when moved by the wind, and soft sedimentary rocks that the sand easily erodes. Over time, the sand wears down the surface into beautiful streamlined shapes that are aligned with the prevailing sand-moving winds. Iran is famous for mega yardangs in Kerman in the south of the country. Stay with us for this episode of Iran Trotter as we follow Javad to discover the spectacular kaluts in Iran.
To most humans, nature means trees, jungles, rivers, and mountains. But is that all there is to this beautiful nature created by the architect of all beauties? God is limitless. He is infinite and has created nature with infinite beauties. Nature has many and varied complicated aspects, and the natural world in Iran is no exception. Many people do not consider deserts and wastelands as part of nature. But the fact is, deserts constitute a large part of the environment on our planet. All we have to do is open our eyes and look at these countless, peerless beauties. I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm traveling to the most pristine areas of my beloved country and uncovering to you its many beauties. This time, I've come to a vast city in Kerman province, a city that in fact forms a major swath of the amazing landscape in Kerman. The fictitious city of Kaluts.
I set out on a 110-kilometer walking journey to the northeast of Kerman province to arrive at my main destination. The Yardangs are located in an area spanning 11,000 square kilometers in the west of Iran's Lut Desert. The Yardangs of Lut cover an area around 150 kilometers long and around 70 kilometers wide. In the words of some researchers, this vast expanse used to be the bed of a lake sometime in the third geological period, and that in fact the Yardangs, or the Kaluts, are made up of brittle sediments lying at the bottom of that lake. At some point in the third geological period, the lake dried up as a result of the major climatic changes that occurred on Earth. Torrential rains and their ensuing humidity in the following periods and water erosion led to the creation of the Kaluts, or Yardangs. Other researchers believe the Yardangs are the result of the alluvial deposits originating from Birjan Mountains in the distant past. Sharp temperature fluctuations in the Lut and the constant blowing of local winds carrying abrasive sediment loads of sandstones battering these Yardangs over the years have led to their erosion. Winds that continue to lash out at these Yardangs and eventually raise beautiful clay terraces to the ground. Trips to the heart of deserts and wastelands have always been risky, but studying up on such places and the risks involved in traveling to them, not to mention carrying a proper map, a GPS device, and the topographic map of the area you are traveling to, can bring the number of risks involved down to a great extent. In all fairness, one of the most beautiful areas in the Lut Desert is the Shahdad Yardangs of Kerman. I mean, there are few places in the world with such beautiful desert landscape. I think nowhere in the world can you find a landscape as vast as this one. Here I am in the Lut Yardangs, hoping for a good trip, and I'm positive it's gonna be a thrill. I stepped onto a part of the river that not many people were interested in traveling to for several reasons. The flight distance between the Yardangs and the Yalan Megadunes in the west of Lut is around 150 kilometers. For several consecutive years, part of the Yalan Megadunes was announced by NASA as one of the hottest spots on Earth. This is an area where temperatures run above 70 degrees in the summer. With no trace of life among them, the Yardangs of Lut look scary to human eyes. Although in recent years, some researchers have discovered and registered a number of plants and insect species in them. But at first look, the fictional town of Kaluts or Yardangs bears no trace of life of any kind. Encountering sandstorms in the desert or getting lost in them, or all the other hidden dangers of such terrains, can put your life at grave risk. But none of those reasons stop me from walking right into the Yardangs. You can enjoy spending time in this beautiful natural landscape with enough information on its climate and terrain, and by using a map and GPS device. No one has found any trace of human habitation in the Kaluts area, not in the past and not in the present eras. But on the outskirts of these beautiful Kaluts, there are many remnants of human habitation from years gone by. The Kaluts are located on the outskirts of Shahdad, a city in Kerman that is among the most ancient in Iran, a place with a more than 6,000-year-old culture and history. The world's oldest metal flag was discovered here. The many qanats and water reservoirs on the outskirts of the Kalutz, as well as the lush gardens of Shahdad, are evidence of human settlement in the distant past. Right at the beginning of the route, I came across an area with a concentration of strange Kalud formations, a place famous for its egg-shaped hills. I have to walk a long distance to get to the heart of the Shahdad Kalutz, but the beautiful elevations you see behind me, which is sort of the prelude to the main Kalutz, are called the egg-shaped hills, and for good reason. They really do look like eggs, although these hills are considered as little Kalutz. The reason they've been abraded more than the other Kalutz in this region is rainfalls and, of course, the type of soil they are made from. And if it goes on like this, rainwater and wind are going to destroy them in the not-too-distant future. Every spot you go to in this region, you see new and different kalutz or yardangs. The majority of those who travel to the Kalutz are not aware of the diversity of the landscapes in this terrain and its natural phenomena. But the fact is, the Kalutz of Kerman are a peerless kaleidoscope of beautiful desert landscapes. Everywhere you look in this region, you see spectacular yet peculiar sights. Around 7 kilometers after the egg-shaped hills, I arrived at another strange yet interesting scenery. From a distance, I thought I was approaching some prehistoric cemetery. But well, this is not a cemetery. These mounds you see here are called the Dolphin Hills. In fact, they are very small kalutz in the vicinity of the big ones. The dual action of wind abrasion and rainwater has chiseled them to look like dolphins swimming on a wave of dust and sand. Every part of the kalutz in Shahdad has its own unique shape. And these Dolphin Hills are among those unique parts of the Shahdad Kalutz. These are really extraordinary, really beautiful. I've been walking around in the Shahdad Kalutz for hours now, deep into the heart of these remarkable protuberances. Although it is fall now, and the best season to travel to the Lut Desert, and of course to the Shahdad Kalutz, early spring is also a good time. Anyway, it's noontime and very hot. It was very cold in the morning, but now the temperature keeps going up, so I'm going to have to take a layer off. The temperature in the desert fluctuates sharply between the morning and the evening. It's always like that. So you have to remember to pack the right clothes for summer and winter weather. That's what it's like in the desert. You get summer and winter weather at the same time, happening within hours of each other on a single day. You should keep that in mind. It's really getting hot here. I just hope it'll stop right there as we approach noontime. Because, I mean, the sun, the heat from the sun can just be unbearable. Although I've already thought of something for a situation like this, one of the most important things we have to carry with us when traveling through deserts and wastelands are glasses, sunglasses that is, they're very important to protecting your eyes against the scorching sun. When the rays of the sun reach the dirt, they are reflected in your direction and bother your eyes. The air here is very clean. That's why there's so much light. So you have to wear sunglasses if you ever come to a place like this. If you don't, your vision is going to get hurt and you're going to get wrinkles around your eyes. And that's what the ladies are very sensitive about. Dazzling beauties of the Kaluz redoubled my enthusiasm for traveling into the heart of these sand formations. But the deeper I walked into them, the more arduous things became. Walking on the sand in the punishing heat requires strenuous effort and drains your energy. The day started out cold, but the temperatures kept going up as I approached midday. The biting autumn cold was nowhere to be felt. Walking on the sand and grit really wears you out after a while. And it makes you sweat a lot, too. It's starting to get really hot. I'd better change into something more suitable. I'm wearing a thin layer, but the short sleeves expose my forearms to the sun, and that means sunburn. The sun is just bearing down on me. I feel like it's burning my face. I mean, I really had to change my clothes to avoid getting sunburn on my arms. The sun can get really annoying round about noontime out in the desert, even if it's not very hot. You're bound to get sunburned. So you must wear long-sleeve shirts with good breathability at the same time. I mean, that's what I always do. And I've never run into any problems because long sleeves have always protected my arms against the sun. Now, more important than wearing long-sleeved shirts out in the desert is to have proper headgear, such as this hat. What this hat does is it prevents the radiation from the sun from reaching your head to a great extent. And as a result, your face, neck, and ears won't get burnt. It really feels good when you wear one of these. And of course, a good pair of sunglasses is a must-have in a place like this. But there is another type of glasses, sunglasses, that I carry with me all the time. These are called storm goggles by some and skiing goggles by others. It's important to pack a pair of these goggles too, because when there is a sandstorm, when strong winds start blowing, they kick up a lot of sand and other particles into the air, and the goggles prevent them from going into your eyes. More important than that, you can see where you're going when you're out in the sticks without worrying about sand getting into your eyes. Man, I'm beat. It really wears you out when you walk on sand and up and down on those little hills. It's just fatiguing. I dare say, walking about in the Kaluz area and the hot areas of Lut Desert in the summer is next to impossible. The temperatures are so high and the surface of the earth so hot, you won't last more than a few kilometers. That's a time when you cannot see any living creatures in the Lut Desert. You can only see them during the night. It's very important to carry enough water when you travel to a place like this. If you're going to spend 2, 3, or 4 days trekking in the desert, make sure you have enough water. That's because you sweat a lot and your body loses a lot of water. And obviously, when that happens, you become dehydrated. In addition to that, you have to eat food that contains salt. But if your food doesn't contain enough salt, you need to eat salty nuts. That's because your body loses a lot of sodium as you sweat in the heat, and that's going to harm your body. Okay, now let's eat an orange. The Kaluz expand intermittently from the west of the Lut Desert towards the southeast. The corridors formed among them look in the same direction as the Kaluz themselves, that is, in the direction of the local winds. They are all very brittle. The shape of each Kaluz depends on how it was first formed, its density, and the direction of the winds that brush against it on their paths. Shifting winds and other erosive factors in the Kalutz Basin has created a variety of them with different shapes and sizes. In some places, winds have filled the depression around the Kalutz with sand, and in other places, they have blown away the sand from around them. Now, let's take a look at the etymology of the word Kalut. Kalut is a blend of two words, Kal and Lut. Together, they mean the city of Lut. In the Khorasan region, in central Iran and along the coast of the Caspian Sea, the word Kal has taken on different meanings. In Khorasan and Sistan and Baluchistan, it's the root of words such as Kalate and Kalat, meaning castle or citadel. It could also mean a hamlet or a village perched on an elevation. In the center of Iran, the word Kalat means a walled-off village. The Kaluts are an imaginary city. From a distance, they look like the remains of a ruined city. Of course, there are a few other areas like this in some parts of the world, but the Kaluts of Iran cover the largest such area in the world. Without human interference and technology, Mother Nature has put on display her unique artistic talent and creativity. It was starting to get dark when, on a nature trip, it's important that the nature traveler find the right spot where they can pitch their tent before the dark sets in. That will ensure a good night's rest without any trouble. I'm going to call it a day now, and I think the best place for me to camp out is right here next to a lone Kalut surrounded by sand. The wind has created this hole here as if to prepare it for someone to set up their tent in. This is perfect because here I'll have my back to the wind, which usually blows from the heights of Sirj Mountains back there towards the Kaluts. I mean, that's why this hole has been created. This Kalut hasn't allowed sand to accumulate here, hence the evenly shaped depression around it. It's just a perfect place to camp out. We're spending the night here. It's a great spot, and hopefully we're going to have a star-studded sky above us. Okay, I've been told I wouldn't be able to find any firewood or shrubs or any living creatures because deep in the heart of the Kaluts, the winds are so strong they won't allow any vegetation to grow on their path. In other words, if a plant grows here, it gets blown away by the wind. But there is an exception to that rule, and that is an area located on the path of floodwaters flowing down to the Kaluts area from the Ravar Mountains. The floods uproot the shrubs on the banks of the rivers nearby, the ones near the Kaluts, that is, and dump them in the seasonal river that's created near here and eventually brings them over to the Kaluts area. I might be able to find something there to make a fire here tonight to keep me and others warm. The temperatures in the Lut Desert fluctuate constantly, making life a bit difficult for nature travelers. Therefore, I always pack warm clothes and a good warm sleeping bag. Another beauty of the desert is its star-studded night sky. In the absence of light pollution, you get a clear view of the twinkling stars and part of the Milky Way. You can spend hours feasting your eyes on those beautiful celestial bodies that adorn the expansive firmament above. I'm glad I found these sticks. It gets really cold out here at night. I rarely make fire during my trips because I set a lot of store by nature and even dry sticks of wood. These sticks are a form of energy. They are no different than oil and gas, so we shouldn't use them recklessly. As I say, I don't make fire when I camp out unless I really have to. Most of the time, I don't need to. And when I do, I make a small one. But in the Lut Desert and in the Shahdad Desert, temperatures fluctuate a lot. I remember coming here 3 years ago. One night, winter was about to come to an end. I mean, like 2 or 3 days to the end of the season, 3 years ago. That night, right here in the Lut Desert, the temperature plunged to -1 degrees. Here's the thing. In the day, at midday I mean, I had traveled deeper into this area and experienced temperatures as high as 43 degrees. That's a huge difference in one single day. It was all very strange to me. But well, that's what deserts are like. It's typical of them. It can get really cold during the night, especially during fall and winter. Therefore, you have to have proper clothes to wear. And if you manage to find a few sticks, you can keep yourself warm and enjoy yourself sitting around a campfire.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
McChrystal's new book is so stuffed with mendacity and banality that it serves as an expose on America's generals after 9/11, says Peter Moss Ryder in an article published under the heading Stanley McChrystal Accidentally Reveals the Dishonesty of U.S. Generals. Stay tuned for more. It is time to make a strange addition to the short list of essential documents on the dishonesty of America's generals. A new book from retired General Stanley McChrystal titled Risk, A User's Guide. McChrystal was removed from his command by President Barack Obama, but afterward created a thriving consulting firm and often appears on TV to talk about war and politics. His notebook is intended to be a primer for corporate leaders trying to navigate the perils of doing business in America. The conceit is straightforward. Hello, I am a retired four-star general who bravely led troops into the battle. And I can tell you everything you need to know about managing risk. There is a lot that McChrystal might teach us, because he was responsible for a series of consequential errors from which valuable lessons could be learned. Those errors include the concoction of a plan in 2009 to defeat the Taliban insurgency by flooding Afghanistan with as many as 80,000 additional U.S. troops. This was the kind of troops and money strategy that succeeded mainly in killing lots of civilians and helping the Taliban return to power. On a less catastrophic scale, McChrystal actively participated in the cover-up of the friendly fire killing of NFL player-turned-troop Pat Tillman, whose 2004 death the Pentagon initially blamed on Taliban, knowing that this was untrue. McChrystal also took the ill-advised risk of allowing a Rolling Stone reporter to embed with his entourage on a trip around Europe. And the resulting article, which conveyed the general's disdain for America's elected leaders, led to his early retirement in 2010. The book Risk is stuffed with so many displays of dishonesty, ignorance, and banality that it's the ultimate self-own for a generation of generals who led America into disaster after 9/11. and profited from it. With his new book, McChrystal turns himself into an accidental whistleblower.